I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, critical talks. The U.S. and Iran are once again taking on the country's nuclear program. We're at the White House. Hidden information. The Department of Justice reveals why it redacted parts of the Epstein files. Now lawmakers respond. Plus, preparing for Lent. We're in Rome to show you how Pope Leo plans to celebrate Ash Wednesday. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast day of the seven founders of the Order of the Servants of Mary. Our top story tonight, President Donald Trump says he thinks Iran wants to make a deal. This comes as the U.S. and Iran hold more indirect talks, trying to avert conflict. The U.S. has been threatening Iran, rushing military assets to the region. And just today, Iran announced the temporary closure of a critical waterway during a military drill. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Veronica, good evening to you. In Geneva, President Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and Jared Kushner led the delegation. And one American official says the talks did make progress.
Iranian state TV announcing today that the country fired live missiles toward the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil passes through, and closed it for safety and maritime concerns. The announcement comes as Iran participates in talks with the U.S. about the country's nuclear program. Just last night, President Donald Trump flying back to Washington, telling reporters Iran's a very tough negotiator and we'll see what can happen.
We could add a deal instead of sending the B-2s in to knock out their nuclear potential, and we had to send the B-2s. I hope they're going to be more reasonable. They want to make a deal.
The alternative, President Trump says?
I don't think they want the consequences of not making a deal. They want to make a deal.
Iran has warned it could launch its own preemptive strike or target American interests across the Middle East and Israel. Today, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, warned the U.S. that the strongest military force in the world may at times be struck so hard that it cannot get up again. And, of course, a warship is a dangerous piece of military hardware. However, more dangerous than that warship is the weapon that can send that warship to the bottom of the sea.
Look, we have peace in the Middle East. Now, you have some flames here and there, but we essentially have peace in the Middle East. And that happened primarily when we did the B-2 attack on the potential nuclear power. They would have had a nuclear weapon within 1 month. If that happened, it would have been a whole different deal.
Iran said its Revolutionary Guard started a drill early Monday in the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, and the Gulf of Oman. It was the second time in recent weeks that Iran has held a live fire drill in the Strait of Hormuz.
They've announced that there are exercises happening. I think that's just to kind of up the pressure during the talks. And at the same time, you have Trump deploying a number of military vessels and aircrafts and so on. So it's maximum pressure while the talks are happening.
This afternoon, Vice President J.D. Vance told Fox News in some ways the negotiations went well. He also emphasized the U.S. has red lines, including no nuclear weapons. Both sides did agree to meet again. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
I want to bring in Jonathan Saya. He is a research analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies focused on Iran. Now, U.S. officials say progress was made, but a lot of details still need to be addressed. What are the expectations for these talks?
So far, we've seen the same tactics deployed by Tehran. Initially, they appear to be open to providing concessions, but once actually talks take place, they try to stall to deter a potential attack. Ultimately, this administration has been very firm on its red line of zero enrichment. Now, the question really is it the time to be negotiating with a regime that is so illegitimate by its own people that has massacred tens of thousands of unarmed civilians? Realistically, the only way that we can actually neutralize all the threats posed by Tehran that are not just military or nuclear, there's also terror networks, is realistically to enable this ongoing anti-Islamist momentum on the ground to really push this regime towards its collapse to facilitate a democratic transition.
Now, as Owen mentioned in his report, Iran temporarily closed the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil passes. What message does this send to the U.S. and the rest of the world?
On one hand, you have Washington actually facilitating talks with Tehran, and that has been the response from the Islamic Republic to launch a drone at our fleet and continue to initiate hostilities around the Persian Gulf. I think the message is very clear that no matter the outreach or the nature of the outreach from Washington, whether it's going to be through sanctions or whether it's going to be through diplomacy, the regime will not change its behavior, and it will continue to really double down on these pillars of anti-Americanism, anti-Israelism, and of course, nuclear weaponization ambitions, despite what the administration does or who's in the White House.
So if that won't change, what do you think the solution is?
Ultimately, if you want to really neutralize the threat, like I mentioned, it's about capitalizing on the momentum on the ground. It's about leveraging the ongoing civic movement in Iran that has been really receptive to Washington. It has responded to President Trump saying and calling on protesters to expand. So it's really a golden opportunity. If we were to miss this, we would risk alienating the Middle East's largest anti-Islamist movement, the most pro-America population across the region. So really, that should be the prime focus. But that said, what we saw in June 2025, even though negotiations were ongoing, that did not deter Israel or America to really strike the different targets inside Iran. So just because there are negotiations, that doesn't mean there won't be attack. If anything, negotiations prior to a campaign would legitimize a military strike.
And in the midst of all of this, the aircraft carrier, the USS Lincoln, is currently positioned near Iran with the world's largest warship, the USS Gerald Ford, on its way. How much pressure is this exerting on Iran?
Great amount of pressure, and it's specifically because comparing this to the prior campaign that was under Operation Midnight Hammer, this signals the amount of buildup in the region signals that should there be another confrontation between the United States and the Islamic Republic, it will not be limited to ballistic missiles or nuclear. It is very likely for this campaign to actually go beyond that, go about decapitating Tehran's leadership and actually targeting the repression apparatus, institutions that are killing Iranians on the ground. So that in itself is an existential threat to the regime. Normal military strikes do not necessarily mean regime collapse or regime change, but if it's targeted and is really a momentum behind it, given the buildup, which seems to be the case, again, that signals something greater. So the stakes are really high for Tehran compared to June 2025.
Jonathan Saya, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also in Geneva, Russian and Ukrainian delegations are meeting for U.S. broker talks. Both sides are far apart on issues such as land security and a possible ceasefire. The talks are due to run over 2 days. The U.S. delegation is represented by Trump's envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. This as Russia launches another series of attacks against Ukraine just hours before the trilateral talks. Ukrainian President Zelensky says 9 people, including children, were injured in the strikes. In the meantime, 2 U.S. Senators, Richard Blumenthal and Sheldon Whitehouse, traveled to Kyiv on Monday for talks with President Zelensky. The aim of their visit is to make the case for a long-stalled sanctions bill that could cripple Russia's main economic engine. Fallout from the release of the Epstein files continues. Attorney General Pam Bondi sent a letter to Congress saying the DOJ has released all relevant documents related to the late convicted sex offender and closed its investigation. However, there are still millions of files that have not been released. Bondi says those files will remain private due to ongoing investigations. But lawmakers are pushing back. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with the latest. Eric, was the directive from Congress to release all the files?
Yeah, that was the directive, Veronica. Good evening to you. The DOJ says about 3 million files will remain private. However, of the files that were released, a list of more than 300 high-profile names were in them, including President Donald Trump, former President Barack Obama, Prince Harry, Bill Gates, and even Bruce Springsteen, to name a few. But Democrats, including Republican Congressman Thomas Massie, who helped force the release of the files, say that they don't have confidence in the current Attorney General, Pam Bondi.
I don't think Pam Bondi has confidence in Pam Bondi. She wasn't confident enough to engage in anything but name-calling in a hearing. And so, no, I don't have confidence in her. She hasn't got any sort of accountability there at the DOJ.
California Representative Robert Garcia goes even further after it was uncovered lawmakers looking at the Epstein files had their records monitored by the DOJ.
The Attorney General, one, should resign or be fired. And she has to answer for why she is now spying on members of Congress and what we're searching for in the Epstein files. So it's very clear that we can't even trust the process.
The DOJ wrote, quote, no records were withheld or redacted on the basis of embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity, including to any government official, public figure, or foreign dignitary. Congressman Jared Moskowitz has seen the files and questions the DOJ's integrity.
Great. So they saw that we were looking at documents. I mean, I'm not embarrassed at the documents I was looking at, so I don't know that it's a big gotcha, but it's inappropriate. We should have been informed of that, if that was going to be the case. To do it secretly is problematic.
Even Republican leaders are agreeing.
Members should obviously have the right to peruse those at their own speed and with their own discretion. And I don't think it's appropriate for anybody to be tracking that. So I will echo that to anybody involved with the DOJ. And I'm sure it was an oversight. That's my guess.
Senators want answers, and they tell me Epstein victims need to be protected, but add all those with ties to the late convicted sex offender must be known.
Those young ladies, as far as I'm concerned, were raped. Under the age of 18, they were sexually abused. So I want everything in the open.
Democrats are claiming that this is the biggest political scandal of their lifetime, and all the documents must be released. Now, this Epstein case isn't going away. Next week, former President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary will be giving a closed deposition to the House Oversight Committee. It's important to note that the Clintons have not been accused of any wrongdoing. Veronica?
Eric, switching gears a bit, what's the latest with the partial government shutdown impacting FEMA and TSA agents?
Yeah, you would think lawmakers were that they would be here up on Capitol Hill working away, but they're currently still on recess. Now, early this morning, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer sent out a release stating, quote, Democrats have sent their counteroffer to Republicans and the White House, but it wouldn't elaborate on any details. You may recall Democrats, they actually sent out their 10-point plan for ICE reforms, which included everything from tighter warrant requirements to unmasking agents to even ending roving patrols. But right now, there just seems no end in sight. Veronica?
Thanks, Eric. Civil rights leader and two-time presidential candidate Reverend Jesse Jackson died peacefully this morning, according to a family statement. The Baptist minister was hospitalized in November after being diagnosed with a progressive, life-threatening neurological disorder similar to Parkinson's disease.
Born in Greenville, South Carolina, he rose to prominence during the civil rights era, joining Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s voting rights cause in 1965. He was just feet away when King was shot and killed on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. Jackson founded what would ultimately become the Rainbow Push Coalition on Chicago's South Side. Its goal was to diversify workforces and to register voters in communities of color nationwide. Jackson met with Pope St. John Paul II a number of times in the 1980s and 90s to advocate for human rights causes at home and abroad. And in the 1980s, Jackson ran the first viable presidential campaign by a black candidate in the United States.
The only time that we win is when we come together.
He really did help bring the awareness of the black political struggle forward. And I don't think that we can underestimate the impact of him, just the act of running. He wasn't fully successful, but I don't know if that mattered.
For the presidency of the United States.
He was once an outspoken pro-life advocate, at one point even endorsing amending the U.S. Constitution to ban abortion. But later, when running for president, Jackson reversed himself, pivoting to a more aggressive stance in support of abortion. On Truth Social, President Trump weighed in on Jackson's life, saying, I knew him well long before becoming president. He was a good man with lots of personality, grit, and street smarts. Jesse Jackson was 84 years old.
Amid ongoing violence in parts of Nigeria, the U.S. is sending troops to help the government. The troops will help train Nigerian forces to fight back against militant groups, some with links to ISIS and other Islamic militants. Joining us now is Father Patrick Alamuku from the Archdiocese of Abuja in Nigeria. Father Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
What is the situation down on the ground right now in your archdiocese in Nigeria?
Well, Abuja is the capital city of Nigeria, and here the capital city and the archdiocese of Abuja, here there is relative peace. There is security. There is the presence of the army, the police. And therefore, we don't have major challenges here as in other parts of the country. In the past couple of years, a priest of Abuja was kidnapped from his parish by the Fulani herdsmen, but he was released after a month in captivity.
How are Nigerians reacting to the news of U.S. troops helping to train soldiers at the request of the government in an effort to combat militant groups, whether in your community or neighboring communities?
Well, there's a lot of joy in the country. In December, when the U.S. strike was witnessed in Sokoto. There was a feeling of joy, of confidence that someone had heard the cry of the people and was willing to help. And therefore, generally, the troops that have arrived in Nigeria are being received with a lot of goodwill. The people are so happy that they're here. In December, after that bomb that hit Nigeria, that was the very first time in 15 years that no church was attacked at Christmas. And so you can imagine the feeling of contentment and joy among the people that they could celebrate Christmas freely without any attacks by these jihadists.
Is your archdiocese involved in any way in helping those affected by some of the violence that we've been seeing recently?
Oh, yes. The IDP camps in Abuja of people who have come from the northeast, from Borno and such places, which were very badly hit by the jihadist attacks. And so the Archdiocese organizes often visits to these IDP camps and allows that priests bring the people and the Christian community bring the people foodstuff, clothes, and medical care.
Father Patrick, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. Academic appointment. Pope Leo names a Harvard professor to a pontifical academy. Meet the new appointee. And see the special traditions the Holy Father follows for his first Ash Wednesday as pontiff. Has named a new member to the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. Dr. Tyler Vanderweel is a Harvard epidemiology professor and director of the Human Flourishing Program. He is also the co-director of the Initiative on Health, Spirituality, and Religion at the university. And right now, we are happy to welcome to the program Tyler Vanderweel himself. Tyler, thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure being with you here today.
So first, tell us, how did you hear the news that you had been named? And of course, how do you feel about the appointment?
Well, I really was delighted to hear about the appointment. I woke up one Monday morning a few weeks ago to find a letter in my inbox saying that I had been appointed by Pope Leo to the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. I was both honored and humbled by the appointment. I had followed the work of the Academy for some years and have been really impressed by all that has taken place. So it's a privilege to be able to try to contribute in the years ahead.
So for viewers who may not fully know, what will you be doing in this new role?
Well, the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences advises the Church on its social teaching and the relevance of Catholic social teaching to contemporary affairs. So they've taken on a number of different topics, ranging from the future of democracy to questions of the environment, disability, relationships, and so on and so forth.
So you'll be discussing and examining very serious topics, but of course, you're no stranger to that. You are also the director of the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard. What type of work do you do there, and how will you bring that experience to the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences?
Well, the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard aims to study and promote human flourishing and also to develop systematic approaches to the integration of knowledge across disciplines, really trying to take the humanities, principally philosophy and theology, and integrate it with the empirical social sciences. So we attempt to measure and study flourishing around the world. We have our Global Flourishing Study, which is a study of over 200,000 individuals in 22 countries on all six populated continents with nationally representative samples in each country. And we're following this group of 200,000 individuals once a year for 5 years to try to discern the distribution and determinants of flourishing. I think what I bring to the Academy is that more quantitative and an epidemiologic lens on these questions of flourishing.
Do you see a link between human flourishing and the Catholic faith, specifically the Incarnation?
I certainly do very much believe that from a Catholic understanding, we really find a restoration to full flourishing, a restoration to our full humanity in Jesus Christ, in the Incarnation. And I think Jesus's life gives us clues as to what we should be pursuing when we're seeking to flourish, both the teaching, but his life, his death, his resurrection. Is what brings full life and full flourishing.
Tyler Vanderweel, congratulations. We look forward to hearing more about your new role, if you'll keep us posted. And of course, thank you so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure being with you here today. Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, papal preparations. Learn about the procession Pope Leo will participate in as part of his Ash Wednesday celebrations in Rome. Will begin the season of Lent with a procession on an ancient Roman hill. The site is known as a place of Christian veneration and pilgrimage for more than 1,500 years. EWTN Vatican correspondent Valentina Di Donato has more.
The Aventine Hill rises quietly above Rome, one of the Eternal City's seven historic heights, and for centuries a place of Christian prayer. But on Ash Wednesday, its quiet streets will fill with footsteps. And it is here that Pope Leo XIV will begin his first Lenten journey as successor of Peter. The Holy Father, joined by cardinals, Benedictine monks, and Dominican friars, will lead an ancient Roman tradition, a penitential procession to the Basilica of Santa Sabina from the Basilica of Sant'Anselmo.
The procession on Ash Wednesday will start here. So the Pope will come in and he'll begin there from the chair. And then we all gather here in procession and go down the center aisle, clear out the door, out through the courtyard, the gateway, and on our way to Santa Sabina.
The procession winds through the Aventine neighborhood, a sign of a journey of repentance and renewal. At Santa Sabina, one of Rome's oldest surviving basilicas, the Pope will celebrate Mass and impose ashes, marking the beginning of Lent. Before they even enter the church, the faithful are reminded what this penitential season is about.
On the door, we have a very important Christian symbol. In the upper left-hand corner can be seen the oldest known depiction of Jesus Christ crucified. It allows us to think of the meaning of Lent, to embrace the suffering of Christ, especially when we consider it from the historical perspective, the evolution of Christian understanding.
And on the Aventine, even nature reflects that mystery. Along the monastery walls, acanthus leaves climb ancient stone and serve as a symbol of rebirth.
The acanthus leaf is a symbol of the resurrection because it gets really vibrant and then it dies and it's like it lays against the ground and it's like completely dead until the spring, so we're in the spring now, and it comes back to life, and then it'll, in a couple of weeks it will start putting up flowers, right, which represents it'll bloom around Easter time.
In Rome, Valentina Di Donato for EWTN News Nightly.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.